This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington, and coming up on Africa News Tonight...
The government says all roles and ranks will be open to citizens from all Commonwealth countries who are aged 18 or over. It's aimed at plugging a gap in recruitment.
That's reporter Henry Ridgewell on Britain's decision to open its military to citizens from Commonwealth countries. Details coming up. Also, Prime Minister of Ethiopia is tackling opposition from within the country's establishment. And Gabon's vice president has been authorized to hold cabinet meetings after the absence of President Ali Bongo for unspecified medical reasons. We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story, it has been a year since the military placed Zimbabwe's longtime leader Robert Mugabe under house arrest, ending his 37 years of rule. Reporter Kudzai Zanawashi speaks to some Zimbabweans about the journey their country has taken since.
The November coup was the climax of a bruising political battle between ZANU-PF factions jostling to succeed the aging Robert Mugabe, who was then 93 years old. Mugabe and his wife Grace sided with a youthful faction, but the army was sympathetic to former Vice President Emmerson Mnangagwa. Mugabe had earlier ousted Mnangagwa and he had gone into exile, returning after the military seized control. Not long after the military acted, Obed Mpofu, the ZANU-PF Secretary for Administration, spoke.
I want to thank, on behalf of the party, our gallant fighters, who are the most disciplined army in the world. They are the most educated army in the world. And we want to thank you, comrades, for helping the masses of Zimbabwe to remove dictatorship.
Mpofu's speech strongly suggested the ruling party would chart a new way forward. The military put Mnangagwa in charge, and in July, he won the election as president. Tendai Joe is a young Zimbabwean. He talks about what he has seen under the new government.
Since the move of President Mugabe, there hasn't been much change, really. The changes that are there are very minute, such that we can't really term them changes. Mnangagwa has been trying to project an image of being a different person than Robert Mugabe, but in actual fact, they are more or less the same.
Joe says there is little more room for free speech, but that the shooting deaths of protesters after the elections show not much has changed. The anniversary received only modest attention in Zimbabwe's media, where more coverage is devoted to economic issues. Since taking office, Mnangagwa has promised a new era for Zimbabwe, one where the country will be open for economic investment and one where free expression is respected. Melinda Mlambo is an entrepreneur.
The only thing that's actually really changed has been the leadership and the face to the government, or the face to the system. But we still have the system in place. We've just been given a platform where everything is sugar-coated. It hasn't changed whatsoever.
Over the past year, the government has tried to be more transparent and made several promises about economic progress. However, inflation is on the rise, the economy remains weak, the shortage of hard currency has gotten worse, and unemployment hasn't improved much. For VOA, this is Kudzai Zinawashe from Harare.
Gabon's vice president has been authorized to hold cabinet meetings as the absence of President Ali Bongo for unspecified medical reasons reaches 3 weeks. The 15-year-old Bongo was hospitalized October 24th while attending a conference in Saudi Arabia. Gabon's government has said he's being treated for fatigue and has greatly improved, while a flurry of rumors has suggested a more serious ailment. Bongo's absence has paralyzed the cabinet because the Constitution says only the president can allow the vice president to call a cabinet meeting. So, the Constitutional Court announced last night that while the president is temporarily unavailable, some of his functions can be carried out by the vice president or prime minister with court authorization. That sparked a backlash from some politicians who said the court had no authority to amend the Constitution. Libyan General Khalifa Haftar did not participate in this week's conference session in Italy on the way forward for Libya. Haftar, who has relied on military force to control northeastern Libya, did meet with the UN-backed Prime Minister Fayez al-Sarraj and other Libyan leaders. He also agreed to join a UN-sponsored national conference in Tripoli in January. Colonel Wolfgang Pustai, a policy and security analyst at the National Council on U.S.-Libya Relations, told VOA's Mohammed El-Shenawi there is no military solution to the Libyan crisis.
There is absolutely no way for a military solution. Any attempt either by the Libyan National Army or by the other major Libyan military power, by the Misrata, to enforce such a solution would definitely end in chaos and would lead to a breakup of the country.
But the neighbors like Egyptian President Sisi and the United Arab Emirates and even Russia are all supporting General Haftar. Would that impact the kind of future solution in Libya?
Well, I think that Russia, Egypt and the others you've mentioned are well aware that the situation in Libya doesn't allow any kind of military solution. I also think that General Haftar is aware of the limits of his own power. I'm sure he knows that there is no way to enforce anything like a final decisive victory over all the others in Libya.
But even in Palermo, General Haftar is reluctant to participate in the conference, assuming that he's going there for just side contacts with President Sisi and the Russians and others. How would you envision a solution in Libya as long as the man with the guns is against any political solution or giving any compromise?
Well, I think it's necessary to engage much more with the major Libyan players, and Palermo could have been a good opportunity for a starting point. But for various reasons, General Haftar decided not to go to Palermo, to the main meeting. I think one of the reasons was that he doesn't want to give the Italians a success. You know that he is strongly supported by the French, and you know that the Italians don't have the very best position in the eastern part of Libya for historical reasons with regard to the colonial time. And the population in eastern Libya is not extremely positive towards the Italians, and I think this is also a reason that he didn't really want to give the Italians a chance for major political success.
What role can you envision for the US to prevent this competition between France and Italy, which is preventing reaching a solution in Libya?
This definitely doesn't make things easier. With regard to the United States, we need to be aware that the Americans don't have any vital interests with regard to Libya. The only thing which matters for them is counterterrorism. But this is also not so much with regard to Libya, but more with regard to the impact of Libya and of instability in Libya towards the whole Sahel region. I think it is necessary for the Americans to realize that the deteriorating situation in Libya would be a threat for important American strategic interests in the region, and they should be engaged a little bit more, in particular with regard to mediation including General Haftar.
That was Colonel Wolfgang Pustai with the that sparked. Fourteen past the hour. You are listening to African News Tonight on The Voice of America. Young, popular, and preaching peace, Ethiopia's Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed has accelerated reform across all sectors of his country since coming to power in April. But his agenda has faced opposition, often from within the country's establishment. Abiy's Attorney General last Monday said that evidence has indicated senior members of the country's security branches tortured political detainees and orchestrated an attack against the prime minister at a rally in June. He also said officials from the military-run Metals and Engineering Corporation embezzled billions of dollars from the country's coffers. Since last Monday, the government has issued arrest warrants for more than 60 officials. To shed light on the matter, we have in studio VOA Salem Solomon. Welcome to Africa News Tonight.
Thanks for having me.
Lots of high-ranking officials arrested. Salem, elaborate on the charges.
Yes, there's a lot of arrests that we're seeing. In fact, today we're learning more. Arrests are ongoing in Ethiopia. The Ethiopia's former deputy intelligence chief has been arrested. The attorney general has been giving all the updates on most of the arrests. These are individuals that were accused of torture and corruption rife within this conglomerate that we're talking about. This is a big company. It's called Metek. It's one of the largest companies in Ethiopia, but it is run by the military and top officials of the Tigray Liberation Front, where major holders of the economy and so this arrest comes at a time when people are talking about reform.
Since most of the individuals, like you just mentioned, arrested are from the Tigray ethnic group, which ruled Ethiopia for the last 27 years, do you anticipate a pushback from this group to the prime minister's latest moves?
That's a very good question. And, the regional leader or head, Debret, for the Tigray region, Debret Ingabra Meskal, yesterday said that, for all these years when Ethiopia, when the Tigrayan people were fighting for democracy and law, the rule of law. And so that he came out in support of Abiy Ahmed's, the prime minister's, move to uproot corruption. And so there's some sort of support, but this is not to say that there aren't people who hold a lot of clout and power within the military, or who had a lot at stake that are going to be disgruntled by this. And so we have yet to see what this means, but it is the actual tangible form of some sort of accountability that we're seeing.
Do you anticipate more arrests?
From what we've heard, within the past 27 plus years, there's a lot of lack of accountability in these big companies. And so some experts are saying that this is not limited to the Tigrayan region or the TPLF, and there were a lot of accomplices that need to be held to account. In fact, with the recent arrests, some who are abetting, even hiding these officials when they're trying to run away, the wife of one of the intelligence persons that were arrested was also arrested because she was trying to hide him. So what that shows you is that, whether you are actively, directly embezzling money, public money, or you're abetting, I think this is a time that we're seeing accountability sinking in Ethiopia's reform.
Just curious, Salem, does this signal that the prime minister is slowly consolidating power or even becoming authoritarian?
Ethiopians on social media, on different platforms, are actually making jokes about how Abiy Ahmed's reform started as a romantic movie. Now it's going into an action. So action movie. On a serious note, you can see that they're very transparent about it. Those are the actions very publicly taken. Maybe there's going to be due process for all the accusations. So we have yet to see what this means. But the arrests are a step in the right direction in terms of holding people who are powerful to account.
And finally, Salem, how is the populace responding to the arrests and charges?
Just as I quickly mentioned, people are taking it different mixed feelings. Some people who were very close to the powerful might hear conversations about disgruntlement. There was a huge documentary exposing the corruption from the state-owned media, and this is not something new. Ethiopia usually has like these exposé kind of documentary films, and so the conversation has been about how they want independent vetting of these incidents that are happening, letting the independent media look into this and things like that. So there's mixed feelings of those who were oppressed being excited, and those who were close to the powerful, frowning upon these changes.
VOA Salem Solomon, thank you for the input.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
This week, hundreds of political leaders, scientists, family planning advocates, and healthcare providers are attending the International Conference on Family Planning in Kigali, Rwanda. Their shared goal is to provide 120 million more women worldwide to access to reliable contraception by 2020. To find out more, the role of one of the largest family planning aid organizations, VOA's Adam Phillips interviewed Simon Cook, the chief executive officer of Marie Stopes International.
A lot of the focus will be on sub-Saharan Africa because that's where a large percentage of the unmet need is.
What is Marie Stopes' specific niche in meeting that need?
We provide subsidized or free services to people who know that contraception exists but don't necessarily have access to it or cannot afford to pay for it.
What about abortion?
We have always provided safe abortion services where we can, obviously based on legal restrictions, but we have always tried to provide women with the options where otherwise they would access unsafe services through, say, a quack doctor or backstreet. And we also do post-abortion care services, which are supporting women who've had failed abortions, who obviously then are in a state of medical emergency.
I know that many of your clients for abortion and contraception are girls and very young women. Can you tell me why?
Many women in West Africa, for example, where family size is 5-6 children, will start childbearing in their teens as adolescents, and that can have a huge long-term detrimental impact on their health. And we also know that women who have children in extreme poverty, often those children are often stunted, they don't develop properly, and having a family size which is affordable and which allows both partners to contribute to the community is really what family planning is about. It's not about just contraception, but it is planning a family effectively to maximize the impact that they can have on their own communities.
How, for example?
Family planning allows women to finish an education or to provide other options for them by spacing effectively. That option doesn't exist in many communities because the physical commodities of contraception do not exist or they're too expensive for people to access. So some women who do have occasional access don't get continuity and therefore cannot necessarily plan their families and when they have their next child.
Where are the greatest cultural challenges to family planning in Africa?
I hate to make generalizations, but I would say in West Africa and the Sahel countries, the culture is for having larger family sizes, and sometimes there is stigma about contracepting or about spacing births. Sometimes there is religious controls. People don't believe that women should take contraceptives. Sometimes it's economic. In some countries, there is a belief that the population needs to grow to support the economy. And in the end, what we focus on is choice. It's simply about what a woman wants.
I imagine you get the most resistance from men who believe that women should have as many children as they possibly can.
For every case where that is true, there are also examples of communities where the men are tremendously supportive of women and they want the same things for their families. So the best cases is where people come together and they plan their families together.
What is Marie Stopes' actual strategy on the ground?
One of the things that our organization tries to do is to take the solutions out to those communities through outreach programs. So we will promote several days in advance what we're there to do and how we're there to help. We will then turn up on the day, and women, sometimes men, will come along to those outreach camps. They will get counseling on what their needs are. They will sign consent, and then we'll provide them with usually free methods of contraception. And in those communities, it's often long-acting methods of contraception, which give them better protection for longer. For example, an IUD, an intrauterine device, or an implant. They will give protection from between 3 and 5 years for implants and up to 10 years with an intrauterine device.
What do you do to ensure that your outreach and education efforts continue to be effective for the longer term?
We often work in what we call public sector support, whereby we're doing outreach services, but together with ministries of health and local health workers who will be there in the community once we leave.
That was Simon Cook, CEO of Marie Stopes International, which is participating in the International Family Planning Conference this week. Britain is to allow citizens from all Commonwealth countries to join its armed forces, even if they never lived in Britain. The new rules are aimed at tackling a recruitment crisis, but as Henry Ridgewell reports from London, campaigners want clarity over the citizenship rights of the new recruits after they leave the services.
Touring Africa earlier this month, Prince Charles paid tribute to soldiers of the former empire who fought for Britain, including here in Abuja, honouring the 2,000 Nigerian troops who lost their lives in the two world wars. Out of the empire came the Commonwealth, and it is from those countries that Britain is now looking to recruit. The government says all roles and ranks will be open to citizens from all Commonwealth countries who are aged 18 or over. It's aimed at plugging a gap in recruitment, with a shortfall in armed forces personnel estimated at over 8,000, says Paul Barnes, visiting fellow at Britain's Royal United Services Institute.
It seems that they're not coming forward in the numbers that they used to. With the gap opening in manning, we need to find a rapid fill, and that rapid fill is often best found from the Commonwealth.
Previously, most Commonwealth recruits had to have lived in Britain for at least 5 years. That has now been dropped, and the armed forces hope to recruit an extra 1,350 people every year through the scheme. Barnes says they will bring added value.
Commonwealth soldiers will come with a high level of education, and they will easily fit into those specialist roles that are more difficult. But also, you gain a strength in terms of diversity. You gain a strength in terms of diversity of view, in decision making, in our perspective of the world, our cultural understanding.
Commonwealth recruits also qualify to become British residents after 4 years or citizens after 5 years' service, a major pull factor for signing up. Dr. Hugh Milroy is CEO of Veterans Aid, which has supported dozens of former Commonwealth soldiers who struggled to gain citizenship.
Under the old system, and I really do hope this has been picked up, you had no access to benefits and you had no right to work. So in fact, for many years, we were stopping people starving. And my advice to anyone coming here to join the armed forces is, this is almost the first thing you want to deal with as soon as you arrive here and join the armed forces. Don't wait till the end, because it takes so long to do.
The British Ministry of Defence told VOA that citizenship requirements had not changed, and new Commonwealth recruits would have to meet the same criteria as before. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC. For all other listeners, please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports. Tune in again at 1800 UTC for another edition of Africa News Tonight. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Skip Sisk, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
Hello, I'm Douglas Simpoga, host of VOA's Reporters Roundtable. Join us every Thursday as we discuss important African topics and events. I'll have a panel of African journalists and expert guests to discuss the topic at hand. We take a deeper look at important African news topics. That's Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
Hello, Africa. This is Peter Clotty, host of VOA's Africa Weekend show, Nightline Africa. Tune in. You will be glad you did.
Nightline Africa is a fast-paced, tightly edited news show designed to keep our listeners engaged from beginning to end. Nightline comes to you live from the Voice of America on the following shortwave frequencies: 6080 kHz, 49.3 meter band, and 15580 kHz, 19.2 meter band.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning into the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 1630 and 1830 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/sunny. It's the Sunny Side of Sports right here on the Voice of America.
Stand up!